but as you probably heard, in fact, we reported it last week on Wake Up Call, that last Thursday, a jury in Denver ruled that the high-profile termination of Native American scholar and activist Professor Ward Churchill by the University of Colorado had been wrongful. This despite the fact that a committee of his quote-unquote faculty peers had found him guilty of a number of academic wrongdoings. The jury agreed to all the main points of the prosecution. First, that the University of Colorado officials used Churchill's political opinions and quote-unquote inflammatory words to fire him from his tenured position at the university, that the termination actually harmed Professor Churchill, and that had it not been for the controversial essay he had written in the wake of September 11, 2001, in which he says a number of things, including that it was an example of the chickens coming home to roost, Churchill would still be teaching at the University of Colorado. In other words, it had nothing to do with the spurious allegations of his own academic quote-unquote misconduct, which supposedly was tucked away within his over dozen self-authored books, countless journal articles, edited collections, lectures, etc., etc. And clearly a victory for academic freedom, but many other areas as well in terms of speaking truth to power. And our guest here is Ward Churchill. Ward, thanks so much for being with us. I know it's earlier there on the West Coast, but it's great to have you on. Thanks for being with us.
Well, pleasure to be here. Actually, I'm in Colorado, not West Coast.
Oh, yeah, you're in Colorado, of course.
I'm an hour closer to your time.
A little closer, yeah. But so tell us, how did you feel about the ruling last week?
Well, I felt vindicated, for lack of a better word, that finally a jury had been able to assess the content of my case in an objective fashion rather than in the carefully constructed process and procedures, kangaroo courts, if you will, of the internal university domain, and the obvious was acknowledged. And I've been saying it was obvious all along, but it could only be obvious if you were privy to the information that was at issue.
Well, that's one of the reasons why I wanted to bring you on, because we've heard so much about it, and so many people took shots at you as a result of what the quote-unquote independent report found and its inaccuracies that it pointed out. But I wanted to share with listeners some of what those quote-unquote inaccuracies were all about. One of them had to do with your research and your writing about the General Allotment Act of 1887. Could you share with us how that was presented and what your representation of it was?
Well, essentially, the hinge of the case, if you can call it that, that resulted in the findings that I had misrepresented the Allotment Act, was that the words that described its implementation were not literally contained in the Act. There was a delegation of authority, and it was implemented in exactly the way I described, but insofar as I referred to the Act itself, there was a misrepresentation. But essentially, that's like saying that a right to privacy is contained in the Constitution is a misrepresentation of the Constitution, and therefore research misconduct would result in a firing. It's a somewhat tricky and superficially complicated argument, but there's nothing complicated about it. You have to interpret the law to understand the meaning. You have to look at subsequent judicial opinions and renderings and so forth to say what the Act meant. I said what the Act meant rather than literally what it said, and therefore they found me guilty of research misconduct. It was that sort of thing straight down the line. And we brought experts during the trial that said not only was I not guilty of research misconduct with regard to interpreting that way, but that I was absolutely correct. And the university really was unable to counter with anything of substance. A thing that's been missing in the media reporting is that the jurors, at least one of them, but in public terms, has said, you know, it wasn't simply that they found that the political content of the 9/11 essay, which was the origin of the case, not only was that content a portion of the motive in firing me ultimately, but that the university's case for research misconduct was not deemed credible in any sense at all by the jury.
We're speaking with Ward Churchill. The other thing, there's a number of other areas that obviously showed the political nature of this committee, this independent commission that was looking into you. The other one was relating to the smallpox, the U.S. Army deliberately using and spreading smallpox against native populations here. And again, it seemed like they were really stretching to discredit some of your work. Could you talk about that?
Well, yeah, the main point was conceded, even in the investigative report, that there was evidence upon which to reach the conclusion that the U.S. Army had, in fact, deliberately spread smallpox by way of blankets on the upper Missouri River in 1837, beginning with the Mandans. Mandans are sort of symbolic of the whole. Having conceded that I was in the main correct, they then attacked a number of details, which, as I've been saying from the get-go, and as was clearly presented during the trial by the experts and during my own testimony, this is a technique that's usually associated with neo-Nazi Holocaust deniers. Well, we don't necessarily deny that the Germans had a program to eradicate Jews, Gypsies, and others, but there's a sort of exaggeration with how many people died as a result of that. Let's attack the numbers. Well, there's a misrepresentation with regard to how people were killed and under which decree. Let's attack the details. Let's undermine the credibility of the ostensibly, at least, conceded main charge and see if we can cast the whole into doubt. And there was, throughout this process, a stated objective of discrediting not only me, but the entire thrust of my scholarship so that it would not be treated as credible, and in a manner that would deter others from entering into the same critical trajectory of analysis that I've come, rightly or wrongly, to represent. So the objectives were much broader all along than simply correcting a misconduct issue as embodied in a given faculty member on a given campus.
Mm-hmm.
There were messages being sent all over the place. And insofar as they were sending this sort of repressive message, using me as the stalking horse or test case on the ability to do that, the jury's finding points to the opposite result. That you don't have to back off, you don't have to compromise what you have concluded on the basis of evidence and experience to be true. You don't have to equivocate that at all. You can hold your ground and you can win. And on that basis, others should be encouraged to enter into this kind of critical analysis.
Mm-hmm.
We've obtained the opposite result.
Mm-hmm. Ward, I'm curious now, because obviously you are no stranger to University of Colorado officials. You've published dozens of, you know, over about a dozen books at least, countless articles in journals and in other magazines and publications. You've lectured for years on these issues, and obviously you've gotten under the skin of a lot of people. How was it for you, even in that whole process, even before the 2001 essay, supposedly, but before, how uncomfortable was it for you in that environment where you had people who would do a witch hunt with you afterwards?
Well, it wasn't especially uncomfortable prior to this, because by and large, the body of faculty you're talking about was always irrelevant to me. They were not doing work with which I intersected. I was, in essence, working out of the University of Colorado as a base of operations. My broader network of colleagues would be national, even international, in scope. And in essence, I suppose from the administrative point of view at the University of Colorado, I was a sort of tokenistic gesture. They could prove their enlightenment in progressive credentials by allowing someone like me to work out of that environment. But it was not collaborative in any particular sense with the general faculty. And were I to return there, which I intend to do, the same situation would prevail, although I'm not going to equivocate with regard to the fraud that was perpetrated, and there's lessons to be learned from that. That's never been my main focus. Academic freedom and academic politics has never been any particular focus in what it is that I've been doing, and I intend to continue to do what it is that I've done that caused me to be targeted in the first place.
Yeah, but you can't, obviously there's people around the world and around the country, certainly academics who are targeted, people who don't have those international and national networks that you have and that recognition, who are probably always under the gun and probably welcome what happened last week in Colorado precisely because they don't have that kind of network.
Well, that's what I was trying to indicate, that it should create a certain amount of space.
Mm-hmm.
For people to do that kind of work, understanding that they can do it, they can hold their ground if they are attacked, and they can win in the process. And this jury result, the result of my case, is not definitive in allowing that to happen. It certainly is a major step in that direction, and other steps need to be taken to conjoin with it to create a pattern which basically tips the scales away from the ability of groups like ACTA. And ACT is heavily represented in the process out here. In fact, you could say Colorado has become ground zero for ACTA over the past few years. They're trying to expand that to Georgia at the present time. But if we can undo the gains that they claim to have made in Colorado, you can see how the dominoes can start to fall in another direction.
Mm-hmm.
So that critical inquiry and interrogation of the historical record and of social and political and economic relations really can flourish rather than be something driven into decline and ultimately to be eliminated from the academy altogether. That's the long-term plan.
Mm-hmm.
How long depends on how rapidly they could consolidate the supposed gains that they had made in my case and extend it into other areas. So we have an opportunity now collectively to kind of reverse that trend. There is something that needs to be brought up here. I keep talking about the findings of my faculty peers. Well, these were not my faculty peers. They were handpicked in an administrative committee, and they're currently being shielded from allegations of scholarly misconduct in their own right on the basis of it being an administrative rather than a faculty or scholarly report. That famous report upon which they keep saying, yeah, but he's a plagiarist, yeah, but he's a falsifier or fabricator or whatever, is itself subject of six solid research misconduct complaints containing about 40 allegations of falsification, fabrication, serial plagiarism,
right,
misrepresentation of sources, and they've refused to investigate any of those. So the findings of fraud formally posited by the University of Colorado is itself accused of being systematically fraudulent.
Right.
There's been no response to that by the institution, and there's been no reportage in the press. Every time I do an interview, I bring that up. We go through it. I've even provided the documentation.
Right.
Okay, and not one newspaper, including the New York Times, has so much as mentioned that fact thus far.
Well, I was going to mention it because I was reading, I guess it was on Wednesday or yesterday, I might have read it, the report, I read the summary of the report that Eric Chaffetz from Cornell, who was chairing the kind of a subcommittee that was looking at the report that was issued against you, and they basically had a whole litany of research misconduct carried out by the same committee, so I'm glad you brought it up because I was going to ask you about that. But I wanted to ask you something on a more personal note, because obviously one of the decisions in the court was based on the point that this definitely harmed you. This whole process impacted you in a negative way. I was wondering if you can share that with us, because obviously, you know, you lose your job, but on many levels, it's that's like the least of it. How was that for you on a personal level? This whole process of attack that you withstood throughout these last few years.
Well, it's been a sort of diversion of my time and attention from things that I consider constructive and was focusing on into this endless repetitive cycle of demonstrating the falsity of what's being said to defend the credibility of my own work against a sounding board in which, as I just indicated, there's been an all but absolute unwillingness to acknowledge that the other side isn't necessarily the be-all, end-all of conclusions. And it remains the case that when I address something, pick any issue you want, anyone who disagrees on ideological grounds or whatever is free to point to that investigative report or the counterpart reports that emanated from the University of Colorado and say, yeah, but you have no integrity. You're a plagiarist. You make things up and so forth.
Right.
And until it becomes more or less equally common knowledge that that report has been accused of all the things that it supposedly conclusively determined I was guilty of, I don't think that's going to go away. So I've got more work to do in that regard in terms of forcing those facts, that reality, into public consciousness. And obviously it's not going to happen through mainstream media, all its fair and balanced and objective reporting. They have space available or time available to repeat the falsehoods about my plagiarism, so-called, and all the rest of it, but they never quite have the space available or the time available, unlike what just happened on this program, which is exceptional, and exceptions prove rules. They never have time to mention, oh, yeah, and by the way, the findings of plagiarism are themselves false, or accused, alleged, charged with being false on substantive grounds, and that's never been investigated.
Are you I guess the court ruling says that you're entitled to go back. Are you planning to go back to the University of Colorado?
Well, there's no court ruling to that effect.
Oh, okay, maybe I misread.
That's the body of law.
Right.
And in cases of wrongful hiring, reinstatement to the original position is the preferred remedy,
mm-hmm.
unless the fired employee doesn't want to go back. Well, I've stated the opposite. There's also been manipulation of statements to the effect that what I'm really interested in is $1 million settlement as opposed to actual reinstatement. That's absolutely false. In fact, you had a situation in the Boulder Daily Camera, so-called newspaper in Boulder, Colorado, where that was the headline, that I was going to be asking for $1 million. I never said that I was asking for $1 million. In fact, I've laughed at that, said I have one thing on the table, and that's reinstatement. I'm not looking for money. I refused to provide information for the jury to even compute monetary damages because you can't compensate for what it is they've tried to do to me personally and to the historical record and to academic freedom in general in monetary terms. They could award me $20 million. It wouldn't accomplish that result. So I've said that, and I've said that consistently. Ultimately, what the Daily Camera says, and having announced the opposite in a headline, is that during an interview I had failed to refute what the reporter had said, and then they attributed the reporter's statement to me.
Incredible.
It is incredible, yeah. But that's what's passing as news coverage on this. And unfortunately, given the sort of selective omissions of factual information in the New York Times piece today, that pattern is repeated in a somewhat more subtle form.
Mm-hmm. Well, I didn't get a look at it. I'm glad you're drawing our attention to it because I haven't seen the article, so definitely take a look at it. Just to remind listeners, we're speaking with Ward Churchill, scholar, educator, activist at the University of Colorado. He's author of numerous books, including one of my favorites, When Predator Came. And we have a few more minutes left. Kara Woodward, you wanted to ask Ward a question.
Yes, actually, good morning, Ward. And I was looking at that New York Times article and seeing that repetition of that statement from the Daily Camera. So I presume that will be something that will probably make the rounds in terms of the news. But I wanted to ask.
It's making rounds. They do say that they didn't really say what I said, which is that it was an outright lie, but they indicated that it probably was inaccurate.
So it's sort of, they kind of tempered the statement a little bit. But I wanted to ask, in terms of returning to campus, I know the focus of the article was, I think, on some of the reactions on campus. Your feelings on actually going back to campus personally as being as a scholar, as a professor, and dealing with being able to deal with your students and your peers effectively.
Well, I've always had a very solid student base. People who are interested, students, that is, both undergraduate and graduate who are interested in the kind of analysis that I do and the subject matter of my courses and so forth. I've taught sections that average roughly four times the average section size University of Colorado, and done that over a sustained period. So we've had a lapse here. A generation of students is 4 to 5 years long, and this has taken up 4 years of my life, but it has also taken up 4 years of time in terms of cycles. So the number of students on campus who actually intersected with me when I was in an active role has diminished considerably. I think that can be rebuilt in a hurry. There are still some people there, and some who are curious. So I think I could reestablish the student constituency that I enjoyed, if you will, in 2004, say. As to faculty, well, by and large, the faculty who comported themselves in an honorable fashion, which is not to say that they necessarily agreed with me on every point, but understood what the issues were and comported themselves accordingly, they're still there. And interestingly enough, they consist of faculty with whom I did interact because of commonality of interest or overlap in interest and so forth during the period when I was an active faculty member there. So my faculty relations, insofar as they ever existed in concrete terms, remain in effect. Mm. I would have no particular problem reentering the environment on those bases.
Okay.
My relationship with the administration is obviously, I don't know, how shall we put it, strained.
Right.
All right? But that's as if to say that a consideration in whether or not someone should be reinstated as to whether it will make the bosses who wrongly fired them in the first place uncomfortable. A hard argument to make and sustain, I would think. And as to the Board of Regents, they were straight down the line with one exception that I could name, caught lying, bold-faced, on the stand. The jury detected and determined that. They acted on that basis. I think there's a broader issue that's also not being raised here as one of the implications of the entire Board of Regents having been shown to have acted in breach of public trust and in violation of their fiduciary responsibility to higher education.
Mm-hmm.
Not to mention being absolutely untrustworthy in their public statements of explanation of what it is they're affecting as policy at the university.
Mm-hmm.
So that's another issue that has yet to be dealt with in the responsible media,
right,
particularly in the Denver area, but I think...
It's a national issue. That's a national issue. I mean, the political pressures, that, especially in public institutions, but even in private universities as well, because private universities depend so much on the senators and the Congress members and the other major public officials who pull the purse strings in many respects. And so I think that's an issue that we will continue following, because it's not only a case of University of Colorado. It happens across the board, across the country. But I wanted to, because we only have about a minute left, Ward, and I'd love to get you back again to talk about these issues further. But I think the timing of the essay that got you into so much trouble and that led to this witch hunt, perhaps it obviously got under the skin of a lot of people right after what happened on 9/11. But the timing of it, if you had to write a similar essay today, it seems like a lot of the points that you made in that essay, public opinion would not necessarily be so against it. Have you given that much thought? Given the Wall Street crisis,
but you know, I would probably say pretty much the same way. I might devote a little further explanation, like some explanation of who Adolf Eichmann was. That was my major miscalculation, in a way, I suppose, is that I assumed that a lot of people would be educated in the area of Nazism, the Holocaust, and so forth, to understand the symbolic nature of Eichmann, what it was he represented. Okay. Obviously, they didn't. But then again, I think it also needs to be said that all the attention has been paid on the people who were upset about the comments, partly on a if-the-shoe-fits basis, I would suppose. What's not mentioned is that there were a whole lot of people who agreed with what I said. And so I would say to everyone out there, if you've got a better way of saying the same sort of thing that I'm saying, extend the analysis, you think you've got a better way of saying it than I said it, then get to it. You know, I've got no monopoly on this. I'll say it the way I say it, according to my lights and my understandings, and I'll reap the consequences and defend my positions accordingly. But other people who think it can be said better should say it better by their lights. We can have lots of people making the same critique from various angles, and it will be more effective for it. But don't just sit there saying nothing and criticize me for having said it in what you consider to be a less effective way than you could have said it yourself. Mm-hmm. Say it.
Well, Ward Churchill,
wanted to add, Ward, that, you know, it's sort of a conventional wisdom among Native people that what goes around comes around, and a lot of that and what you said was just the action of the prophecies coming true. In other words, to say that, you know, we've been telling the Americans that they're making their own bed, and they're not paying attention to it anyway, so this is bound to happen to them. And I just wanted to bring that as some of the voices of the Native people here in the United States.
Teokas and Gosar. So, Ward Churchill, I want to just thank you so much for sharing your time with us this morning. And hopefully we'll continue this conversation, ongoing conversation. And we wish you the best as you move back into this, new phase post the court ruling from last week.
Well, thank you, and I look forward to spending a little more time. I'll get up before dawn anytime to a program like this. So,
all right.
Appreciation for making the time available.
Okay, Ward Churchill, again, scholar, educator, activist, author, and definitely a powerful voice in this very difficult time. It's